Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and these days more than daily politics podcast. And we are back after the Christmas break. As we look ahead to a new year and, as some in government like to describe, a new dawn, what exactly does Boris Johnson and his team have planned? Well, to discuss that, I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth, and we're going to look at the various aspects of the new government. Now they have a majority of 80. First up, James, we know that this is a government which isn't particularly keen on spending too much of 2020 saying the B word or talking about Brexit. There's a plan to de-dramatise it. When it comes to the Brexit strategy, where exactly do you think we are heading?
So next week, we're going to see the single greatest demonstration of legislative force since the Blair era, as the withdrawal agreement bill is pushed through its common stages in just a few days. And what that is going to show is that when Boris Johnson wants something, with this House of Commons, he's got the majority to get it through. You know, all the endless, you know, roll up that copy of Erskine May, it will not be wanted these next few years. All those endless debates about amendments and procedure that we got so used to in the last Parliament are simply irrelevant. You know, we've seen the Labour and the Lib Dems putting down amendments, but we know that they are destined for defeat. And I think that this is designed to send out two messages, one at home and one abroad. The message at home to voters is we are getting Brexit done as we promised, and we will enable the country to move on from that, you know, in short order. The message it is meant to send for chancelleries of Europe is, look, you know, we command this House of Commons, and what we want goes. So don't think this is going to be like phase one, where even different cabinet ministers had different agendas going into the Brexit talks, and the EU was very easily able to play different bits of the UK government off against each other, and the UK Parliament off against the UK government. This is going to be a completely different type of negotiation, because what the Prime Minister wants, the Prime Minister will get in terms of his ability to get things through Parliament domestically. And so that means that there's no way that Parliament is going to be able to force him to extend the transition period, given that he doesn't want to. And so December 2020 really is a hard deadline for at least some form of agreement. Now, that agreement might be essentially to kind of carry on talking and keep things as they are as you do that, but it will be a deadline for an agreement. But I think one of the other things, as you said in your introduction, Katie, the government are keen to do, is they don't want this year to be dominated by talk about Brexit and trade deals, etc., etc., etc. So I think what you're going to see them do is try and play everything down, to try and minimise the extent to which leaving without any further agreement at the end of December, at the end of this year, would be a dramatic moment. So I think what you'll see is a kind of attempt to just treat this, to try and make this seem a much more routine negotiation. For example, you know, I understand that their aim is to stop, you know, the kind of everyone goes to Brussels and goes into tunnels and corridors and all that kind of thing, and just make this much more of a kind of calm process than it has been in the past.
Fraser, in your Telegraph column, you write about the opportunity this government has when it comes to pursuing a Brexit deal that could potentially keep both sides happy. It could be friendly, but part of that will not just to be talking to Europe, at the same time talking to other countries like America.
Yes, the government's Brexit strategy, well, the new one anyway, has got a few strands to it. One is to change the tone very much. So previously, Theresa May basically spoke as if she was going off to war against Johnny Foreigner. She said in 2017, give me a big general election majority so I can go off and bat for Britain. And of course, she didn't get that majority. The talks were acrimonious. There was, you know, very much a huge amount of bad blood between Britain and the rest of the EU. The Prime Minister has told his cabinet that this has got to change immediately. The word he's using is love bomb. He wants them to love bomb the EU. He wants everything anybody says about Europe to be a declaration of love for great, looking forward to a great partnership. He wants Britain to be the EU's number one ally in the world. after Brexit, and to present this as being a win-win. Now, this is a bit of a problem for Michel Barnier, who previously and privately has said there's no such thing as a win-win Brexit, it can only ever be lose-lose. But we've got a new commission now that's taking a bit more of it, realises that the Brexit deal they agree will pretty much decide the next few years, and the EU's diplomatic clout will, to a large extent, be decided by its relationship with Britain. And Macron, for example, is in a bit of a tight spot right now. He's really mishandled his relationship with Trump, and he's now being a lot more friendly to Britain because he needs favours from London to act as a bridge to America, our historical rule. Secondly, there's not going to be talk about a cliff edge anymore. This was very much a theme of the last Brexit talks. If you don't give us what we want, we're going to walk away. No deal's better than a bad deal. That wasn't very effective because it wasn't very plausible. We now know that Philip Hammond and David Gough, the two guys at the Treasury team, were doing everything they could to make sure there was not a no-deal option. But that has now been taken off the table because we have got an agreement in Northern Ireland, we've got an agreement on air travel, we've got an agreement on a whole bunch of other things. So the gradient of that cliff edge has been shaved down quite substantially. And then thirdly, the unspoken threat will be if the EU doesn't make Britain an offer, then America will do. I understand that the Americans have been very friendly right now, saying that they have got an oven-ready trade deal of their own to offer Britain, basically signed and ready to go. Now, of course, that's an exaggeration because the American system of government means that Congress has to decide these things. It's not a gift of the White House. But if that's the overall attitude of the Americans, this will be quite useful for Britain and useful in focusing minds in Brussels. They intend to, for example, if there's a trip to Paris and Berlin, this will be followed immediately with a trip to Ottawa and Washington. There'll be talk about exploring trade deals with Asia as well, with Latin America, to point out that global Britain has got global options. But this, the aim anyway, is to do this in a friendly way that emphasises the potential for UK-EU cooperation rather than the antagonistic way which worked so badly for Theresa May and badly for the EU.
And James, just on that, when it comes to, I suppose, the team which should be focusing on Europe at least, we have the Europe unit which is being led by David Frost. How is that shaping up? Has the team been fully completed yet?
No, but I think that David, I think they want Boris Johnson and his kind of closest team trust David Frost completely. So I think we can expect him to carry on doing the negotiations. I think another reason why we can expect him to carry on doing the negotiations is that Number 10 think that David Frost is kind of quite a self-effacing character. He doesn't have a big media profile in. He could probably even walk down, he could certainly walk down our street without being recognised, and he could probably walk down Whitehall without being kind of mobbed. And I think that quite suits the way that Number 10 want to approach this. You know, if you had a high profile cabinet minister personally conducting the negotiations, there would be a very different feel to this. I think, in truth, this negotiation is essentially going to be run out of Number 10 in the Cabinet Office. You know, Brexit, the Brexit department is being wound up, and I think you'll see a lot more of a focus on that. I think it was very interesting what Ewan Fraser was saying about the kind of idea of kind of simultaneous negotiations with other countries. I think there will be an attempt to, not in a kind of crude, threatening way, but in a not entirely subtle way, to kind of, to, as Fraser put it, point out that the UK has options. In other words, if the EU wants to cut up rough, the EU could find itself losing the UK entirely from its regulatory and diplomatic orbit, which, you know, definitely would pose some potential problems for the EU down the line. I think one of the other big differences is the EU, I think one of the things that was striking about phase one of the Brexit process was that while the UK was divided in all the ways we've been talking about, you know, within government, between government and parliament, you know, the EU stayed remarkably disciplined and acted as a kind of collective force. That will be harder for it to do in stage two, because in phase one, essentially, all the EU countries agreed. They all wanted the UK to pay a hefty sum on leaving. They all wanted to guarantee the rights of their citizens who are currently resident in the UK. And they all wanted, in protecting Ireland, to demonstrate the kind of value of EU membership to smaller countries. I think in phase two, countries' economic interests are, you know, as in any trade negotiation, the interests of all the EU 27 are nowhere near as aligned as they were in phase one.
Now, when it comes to the events to look ahead to in the months to come. There is the so-called Valentine's Massacre that we will get to. But before that, there is one fiscal event we've been waiting for some time, Fraser, and that is the budget. What can we expect from that in terms of timing and, I suppose, substance?
Well, on timing, the official word is to expect a budget in February. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a bit later than that, in March. And also, from what I gather, we can expect perhaps a comprehensive spending review in the summer as well. That isn't currently in the diary, but I think I wouldn't be surprised if one happens. And then perhaps even another budget at the end of the year, because technically the budgets are supposed to happen now in November. This was the great Philip Hammond reform. So we'll get the date of the budget quite soon, probably early next week. And it will be quite interesting because this will be a government which fought a general election on quite a sort of giveaway agenda. I mean, sure, there's perhaps not as much giving away as the Prime Minister would have liked. He lost a battle with his campaign chief to be offering lots of giveaways. And had actually the Tories lost the election, then Boris might have been saying, look, I told you so, we should have offered more. As it stands, they will be borrowing more, they will be spending more. And also, the interesting thing will be where they spend. There's going to be a new look at the Treasury spending formula. This is something that Prime Minister told you, Katie and James, when you interviewed him last month, that the Treasury had previously assessed these things in ways that benefited the South East. But there's a new way of doing the finances, a new way of looking at spending projects, and that's going to benefit places outside the South East. So we can expect, I think, a budget focused very much on these new constituencies who returned the Tories with a majority. So I think we can basically see an end to austerity. That's been the case for some time. We can see a more, I wouldn't say spendthrift Tory government, actually, but certainly a more relaxed about never balancing the books. That was an Osborne fantasy, really. Osborne just kept saying, let me balance the books, but not just yet. I think that'll be formalised under Sajid Javid's budget. And we can see the financial contours of this sort of one nation conservatism that Boris Johnson's been talking about for quite some time.
Yes, I think when you're looking at everything this government is planning to do, a lot of it does relate back to the so-called red wall, which firmly crumbled during the election. All these Labour heartlands that have turned blue, and how do you actually just make that wall change colour completely by the time of the next election? I think that one of the things when Boris Johnson spoke to us about the spending rules was this idea that the Treasury has been too focused with short-term gain. So the fact that if you invest in areas in the south, it would work better because you could see the economic case, and it's moving away from that. James, one of the areas where we are expecting to see this renewed focus on keeping these Labour voters who, in the Tories' mind, and many in Number 10 have simply lent their votes, is we're going to see a renewed attempt to reform Whitehall. And I think there are several strands, and we're going to touch on a blog post that some of our listeners may already read shortly. But one of the things is we are expecting a big reshuffle, which is going to correspond with a shake-up of Whitehall departments. Just before the Christmas break, we saw the fact that actually most people stayed in place in the cabinet. But what are we expecting to happen in February?
So we're expecting a big reshuffle. Now, remember that when Boris Johnson first became Prime Minister, he dispensed with far more ministers, cabinet ministers, from the May government than had been expected. It took everyone by surprise by how sweeping it was. And I think the thinking is that this February reshuffle looks like being pretty sweeping again. Remember, Boris Johnson at the moment, he's not beholden to any one faction in the cabinet, which gives him, or in the parliamentary party, which gives him a lot of license about what he does in terms of ministerial appointments. I also think that they have had I thought that, weirdly enough, how little was done in the post-election reshuffle, if Nicky Morgan being asked to stay on as Culture Secretary for a few more weeks, suggests that the reshuffle coming is bigger. Because what it essentially said is, we're going to be moving so many pieces around the board come February, we don't want to have to kind of make any of our moves now. It was striking during the election campaign, how much of the Boris Johnson show it was on the Tory side. There were only a handful of other cabinet ministers who ever really made public appearances. I would expect to see a return for Penny Mordaunt, which I think will be a sign that there is a way back under Boris Johnson. Johnson, that he is prepared to kind of bring people back who he's clashed with in the past. I think that Brandon Lewis, the security minister who was quite prominent in the election campaign, can expect a bigger role. But I think you also, I think I would be slightly nervous if I was one of those cabinet ministers who is seen as having underperformed over the past few months.
Can you name names, James?
Well, I think, you know, Teresa Villiers as Environment Secretary is probably on a slightly sticky wicket, in that, you know, she's not exactly made waves in that department. I also think that one other thing to watch out for is, I think Boris Johnson is very keen that cabinet ministers don't go on for as long as they have previously. And so I think people who speak a lot in cabinet are probably slightly vulnerable too.
Yeah, I think if you just even look at the figures Number 10 very keen to put onto the airwaves during that election, and I do think that was reflected to the people they trust the most. Rishi Sunak was rarely off the television in comparison to Boris Johnson. I think Robert Jenrick also emerged as someone they think can at least hold a line on the airwaves. Dominic Raab is someone they have trusted for some time. These people, of course, could move, but there is a sense that, and I think finally, Michael Gove is very clearly someone that Number 10 rely on quite heavily, which is a world away.
But doesn't he gab on like a hairdresser in cabinet, James?
I think it's the value of the contribution, I think, if you see what I mean. There was a famous kind of cabinet conference call on Brexit strategy when it was quite clear to most people that Boris Johnson just wanted to get off the phone, and a succession of cabinet ministers kind of lined up to kind of say to the Prime Minister they just wanted him to know how much he had their support as he undertook this difficult and tricky negotiation. It was quite clear that it was on a Sunday, and it's quite clear he just wanted to get back to doing whatever he was doing. So no, I think there's an element of that. I think it's also telling what media people were asked to do. And I think that they, for all the run-ins Boris Johnson and Michael Gove had in the past, I think that relationship, it's never going to go back to where it was pre-June 2016. But I think it is as close to being repaired as it is possible to be.
Now, another element in this is we expect to have a slimmed-down cabinet with some new faces and many faces leaving. But there's also a plan to try and reform the civil service and the public sector through that. We have been treated to a blog post over the Christmas season from Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson's senior aide. That is available to read on the Coffee House website, as well as his personal blog, depending on your preference. And in it, he said that Number 10 are hiring and went on to list several categories, from data-driven roles to being Dom Cummings' personal assistant, moving on to communications, along with the various things you would need for each role. Now, there's been some amusement from the job advert on social media and elsewhere, part, I think, due to the various reference to characters and novels when it comes to whether or not you'd be good, and also the warning that some of these jobs will ruin your love life, so you'd just better not have one. Was the moral of the story. Fraser, what did you take from that blog post?
It's like lots of people, I was nodding along in fervent agreement with a lot of it. Some of it I did think was a bit much. I mean, but you know, the thing is, he's fundamentally right in saying, well, there are some jobs that are so important that you ought not really to expect of a work-life balance. If you're giving your life to the country in a really important government role like that, you should, for the length of time you're doing it, it should be the most important thing that you do. You shouldn't be expecting to have much of a sort of social life in the evenings. It reminds me of that scene in West Wing, actually, when Leo McGarry's wife was complaining that the job was taking its toll on her marriage. And she was saying, this job isn't more important than your marriage. And Leo replied to her, actually it is. I'm chief of staff for the president. For the duration of time I'm doing this job, it is more important than my marriage. And I think, you know, that deserves to be said sometimes. There are some jobs that do require everything. And I think rather than put people off, it will intrigue a lot of people that to have such a sort of unappealing job description, saying, if you don't fit in, I'll bin you within 2 weeks. That's one of the things he says. And now, who's going to leave a well-paid job outside government for something like that? But then again, it sounds so crazy. I think he's going to be inundated with applications. I also think he's right in saying that there are far too many people like me. In other words, people with arts degrees who don't really have any sort of scientific or mathematical training, who are put in charge of government policy, where the skill which you've really got is to blang on pretending you know about something when in fact you don't. This is the quintessential sort of arts graduate stroke PPE skill. Dominic Cummings has had enough of it, even though he's an arts graduate from Oxford himself. He wants people with more scientific background. I think he's wrong to say that you should be looking at people straight from university or a very good uni. When we do our spectator recruitments, we set a very different...
And just on that, it's probably worth noting out that a few people did get in touch to say that when they read Dominic Cummings' blog post, they had a slight feeling of, not perhaps deja vu, but it bore some resemblance to spectator intern applications.
Yeah, because he says something that we say, which is that that your character and your aptitude and your temperament will trump experience or seniority. The right, if you love a job and you've got an ability for it, it shouldn't matter too much where you're from. Which, and also in my opinion, it shouldn't matter what your degree's in, it shouldn't matter what age you are. When we do our internships, we get people. One of our most successful interns, Catherine Forster, was a 48-year-old mother of three, without any sort of scientific degrees behind her. So if I were Dominic Cummings, I'd be a bit more open-minded in where you might find exceptional talent. I also would have set an aptitude test, really, because he's going to get so many people emailing that, how's he going to sift them out? It'll be the quality of her letter, and I suspect that arts graduates will be best at writing the persuasive letter. But fundamentally, it shows, it's importantly, as you said in your blog about it, Katie, it shows that he's thinking outside the box. He intends to recruit outsiders to government. The method, the very fact that he's recruiting for number 10 on this sort of personal blog, in this very personal, a very Dom Cummings way, shows that this government is going to do and act and speak very, very differently to what we're used to.
And James, just on that, one of the things that I was struck by in that blog was a line where Dominic comes to saying part of the reason they can do various stages of change and plans that they have is because they ultimately, as a government of a majority of 80, had the space and time to make some changes that perhaps will be unpopular, but there's time to put them in place and improve them from there. So I suppose for all those people who were suggesting that now we had a majority government, things could potentially get quite boring, and perhaps this podcast would have less to talk about. It appears to suggest the opposite.
I'll make one prediction with total and utter confidence about this year in politics, is that it won't be dull. I mean, I always thought all this speculation about Dominic Cummings leaving was rather off beam, because this is a guy who spent a long time thinking about how the British state should run, how it should work. You know, he's not going to pass up the chance to try and persuade Boris Johnson to implement that vision. The thing I thought reading that blog post is that this is sensible in that there has been some kind of quite big, profound developments in the way that in intellectual thought in the last decade or so. And that is not really reflected in Whitehall. I suppose the nearest you get to it is the kind of nudge unit in the Cabinet Office. And, you know, I suppose, and the success of making the workplace pension, you know, opt out rather than opt in. So there are definitely things that can be learned there. I would add one note, though. I was talking to someone else who's a very influential member of the Boris Johnson team, and they were saying that the Labour leadership contest will have a much bigger impact on this government than people realise, because there's no doubt that doubts about Jeremy Corbyn basically kept the Labour vote down at the general election. You know, Corbyn was one of the big drags on Labour's support. If Labour could find a new leader who didn't act as a drag on their support, and Labour went ahead in the polls, that would be a very different atmosphere to operate in for this government than it is currently. There are lots of new MPs in this parliament, and one thing we know about new MPs is they get very jumpy about the opinion polls when you go through a period of being behind. So I think the Labour leadership contest will actually have quite an impact on how radical this government feels able to be, which is, you know, if this government is consistently ahead in the polls, it will feel more confident about being bold and doing things differently, and it will come under less pressure from its parliamentary party and basically being given more room to manoeuvre.
Something else on the Don Cummings job advert that jumped out at me, I mean, you guys might have been following this closer than me, that when he was first hired by the government, the word was his contract would last until the end of Brexit, so October the 31st, and he was being hired to bring that particular job. In the job advert, he was talking about how he would like somebody to make him almost redundant within 2 years' time. In other words, he sees at least a 2-year time frame in being the person who is Boris Johnson's chief of staff and therefore one of the most influential figures of the government, perhaps more influential than any single cabinet member. So I didn't really think that he would, you know, having had played such a role in winning the election, would then walk off, especially as he's spent so long thinking about government. But James, had you picked up until this point that Dominic Cummings is basically here to stay?
I think the best way to read that, I think, is that he basically hopes that this system, by making him almost redundant, can make it possible for him to stay in 2 years' time, if you see what I mean. Because, you know, there is only a certain amount of time that one can work at the pace and intensity that this Downing Street team has been working at. And they obviously, you know, you are going to see people burning out if you carry on working at this pace. But obviously, if you can come out of a different setup and a different system, then things start to become very different.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And we will, of course, be here throughout all the twists and turns as they unfold in the year ahead.
Oh, one other thing. On Brexit nights, we're going to be having a few subscribers around for drinks here at The Spectator. And then we're going around the corner to listen to the Big Ben be brought back to Chime 11. So if you would like to come and join us, then watch out for further postings on this. We'll have a website at some point where you can express your interest. But if you'd like to come along,
and have to pass an aptitude test.
Yeah, exactly. We'll set a Dom Cummings test
and be a weirdo.
Always welcome.